Welcome to Pints with Treebeard. I'm Jameson Winter. I am the dean of the upper school at Augustine School here in Jackson, Tennessee. And today I'm joined by Josh Edgren. Josh, tell us about yourself.
Hello, I'm Josh Edgren. I'm a pastor and teacher in Moscow, Idaho, way up north. Jameson, what are we talking about today? What's the word of the day?
Today we've decided to talk about an aspect of fatherhood, which is the idea of gravitas. What is gravitas? How do we get
it? Hold on. Stop right there. Is it gravitas or is it gravitas? Because we've got to get this straight.
I say gravitas. Usually.
Fantastic. So I'll do whatever I feel like then.
Yeah,
go on.
Yeah, you can switch back and forth as you will. I won't hold your feet to the fire.
Roger.
But we're going to talk about gravitas and what it is, why it matters for fathers, how do you get it. We've been talking, obviously, about parenthood in general, then fatherhood in general. This is one particular aspect of fatherhood. And I thought it was fitting just to start with a basic definition. So how would we define gravitas? What is it that we're talking about? Well, this isn't a word that we made up. It's not a word that English speakers made up. The idea, at least, goes back maybe in perpetuity, but at least to the Greeks and Romans. And this is the idea of weightiness, seriousness, being dignified, being stable. I think often, not always, but often when I think of gravitas in a kind of ancient mindset, you know, what ideas from the ancient world are kind of part and parcel with the idea of gravitas. I think often of the Stoics, not because it's a one-to-one kind of comparison or correlation. There's certainly some things we need to reject from the Stoics, but much of what they're getting at has to do with gravitas. It has to do with being a man who has this kind of weightiness and this seriousness. So that's a brief definition. Any other thoughts there on kind of painting a rough outline of the term gravitas, because it's not something that we use in normal conversation.
Right. Well, sort of. I mean, because the connection between gravitas and gravity is clear, right? That those are the same ideas, right? So we just don't think about applying the weightiness to people. So that's the thing that's foreign. We think about gravity all the time, right? It's a fundamental aspect of nature. And we have to, it's not just a good idea, it's the law. So, so this is a metaphor in some respects. We're thinking about the quality of a thing to pull other things towards itself, right? We're thinking about the quality of a thing to have other things in its orbit. We're thinking about how hard it is to move a thing. And these are all, I mean, I'm a physics guy, right? These are all physics-related metaphors. So when you think about a person having gravitas, we think about them having other people or things in their orbit. We think about if a man has gravitas, he is not easily moved. If a man has gravitas, he draws others to himself. Is that fair to say? Am I pushing those physical metaphors too far?
No, I think that's right. And I have a science question for you, which you should know because you should know everything about science, especially if it's in the realm of physics.
I do.
And,
that's right.
And that is, do you know around when we started calling those planetary forces gravity as people? Because my thought would be that that developed far later and that they observed those relations between the spheres and chose to call it after this idea of gravitas, which is something that was a human quality that we're now using metaphorically to represent the planets and their relations rather than vice versa, kind of like the theopomorphic language thing that we keep bringing up.
That's wonderful. You're absolutely right. No, I don't know the exact date when the term gravity began to be applied to the movement of the heavenly spheres. It can't have been very far from Newton's universal law of gravitation, which he formulated in 1666, which talked about how the reason why the planets do what they do is because of this attractive force between them. And so I don't know if he then coined the term or applied the term there or if it was already. It could be the thing that goes back, but my guess would be we're talking 17th century. So no, you're exactly right, and I've never thought about that before. It's a metaphor that runs the other way. We apply the term to planets that originated with people. That's really interesting.
Right, and there's some literalness to the term as well. I'm sure that this is a term that they would have used in Greece and Rome to refer to weighty, heavy things. But still, they're seizing on that word to apply it to a man in particular and show that he, like you said, draws others into his orbit. And, you know, we could ask, why is that? Why is it that a man with gravitas pulls others to him? What is it about him that's attractive? Because, okay, that's what's happening to him, or maybe through him, not to him, but, you know, to others through him, they're being drawn. But what is it about him that's drawing? What is it, in other words, that people call gravitas?
And before we go off on that too much, can we pause and say that gravitas is not essentially good? The gravity is not moral. So a bad man can have gravitas. Is that fair?
I don't know if that's how the Romans would have used the term. I tend to think not, because so much of their society, and I'm historically ignorant here on the specific use of this word in Rome, it seems as though it's held up as a virtue, which means that it is the way to do this in a positive form. They're so focused on the virtue of a good man. In fact, virtue is, it comes from vir, which is V-I-R, the Latin word for man, right? Virtue is the essence of being a good man. So the idea that gravitas is tied to virtue so closely, at least to my knowledge, seems to indicate that it is actually positive inherently. That doesn't mean that there's not some other form of attracting people to you that is negative, but I think they would either call that something else or use some kind of qualification to show that this is not gravitas, actually. You can think of it like masculinity. Masculinity is inherently good. And if you're calling things bad, masculine, well, they're not actually masculine, right? The most masculine man is Christ himself, and there's nothing bad in him. So, you know, somebody who can bite the neck off of a bottle and chew the glass in his mouth and spit it out isn't being masculine. He's actually being a bad man. Right. But whatever he is, it's not masculinity. I think that a similar kind of thing is happening with gravitas in the way that it's used traditionally.
So you could have gravitas and lack other virtues.
Yes.
Right. Just like you could have courage and lack yes. other virtues. So you could be a wicked, intemperate man who is very courageous. In the same sense, you could have gravitas without having wisdom, prudence, etc., etc. And also, there are probably, if we're thinking in Aristotelian terms, right, there's, if virtue is the mean between two excesses, you would have the deficiency of gravitas and the excess of gravitas, which could bear some superficial similarity to the thing itself. Okay, all right, I'm tracking now. I'm tracking.
Yes, and that way it's similar to the sophists, right? These were professional rhetoricians. They were skilled. They were extremely good at the art of rhetoric. They were excellent, even. They were, in some sense, the pinnacle of the rhetorical craft. And yet, they are so often kind of chastised by history or by some of their contemporaries for essentially selling themselves out to the highest bidder and saying, I'll use my rhetorical skill in the public square to convince the people of whatever you want me to convince them of. And so in that way, yes, you could have gravitas as a man and yet lack other good virtues. That's a good way to think about it. But I want to drill down a little bit more on what it is when a man has gravitas that is drawing you to him. And I'll maybe ask you to do the positive side of this. I have at least a few thoughts that are negative. What are the things that he is not that draws you to him? Well, he's not a flippant man.
Flippancy.
That's right. That's right. He's not flippant. He's not wishy-washy, straying between opinions back and forth. He's not unbridled. He doesn't lack self-control. And otherwise, he's not controlled and ruled either by his emotions or his circumstances. And he's not shallow. There's a depth to him that is intriguing, that draws you in, that wants you to explore it. You want to get to know him because you recognize that there's substance there. If you ran into him, you would hit the wall. You wouldn't just kind of bowl over him, right? So any ideas on that, either on the negative side or the positive side of what is it that draws you to him?
No, I think that's right. I think you're hitting on it. It's the fact that he's not easily moved. He's grounded. He's dependable. He's, and not as dependable in like, yes, Clarence, he's dependable. Always shows up to work on time. But dependable in the sense that he's not easily affected by things external to him. He's an unstoppable force. That's the idea, right? So wherever he is going to be a place that others can gather, right? What could that look like? Just putting some flesh on the bones, right? A man who knows what he thinks. And this can be artificial, right? It can be confidence based upon nothing, but often it comes from being well-read, well-researched, knowing the breadth of the topic, right? It can also come from experience, right? When he says he's going to do something, he does it. Why? Because he's done it before. He knows how to do it, right? It has some overlap with courage. He is confident of success, and what he puts his hand to, he will do. So you say not flippant, right? Well, let's take the reverse of that. If flippancy is taking something serious and treating it as if it were not, the opposite of that would be taking something serious and treating it as if it were serious. So taking something holy and treating it holy, taking something important and treating it importantly. And also taking something trivial and treating it trivially. That's a piece. It's not that he never treats anything trivially. It's that a man with gravitas will treat things as they ought to be treated. Can you think of examples? Let's put more flesh on it. Give me examples in literature. Give me examples in your experience. First and foremost, give me examples from the scriptures. Where do you see gravitas?
Well, as you spoke, you mentioned this idea of knowing what you think, having experience, speaking to things because you've read widely, you understand what's happening, all of that. And it called to mind this word that we haven't mentioned yet, which is authority. Right? You're speaking with authority.
Right.
So I'll use a couple of examples from Christ. On the authority side of things, again, who was the most masculine man to ever live? It was Christ. Who was the man with the most gravitas to ever live? Also Christ, right? And you see that again and again and again in his confrontation with the Pharisees and the Sadducees and all of these teachers in Israel who continually say, what? Who is this man who speaks with such authority? They're constantly in awe of the authority with which he speaks, which goes not just to the fact that he's saying things with confidence, but that he's saying things that are true. They're recognizing, even when they hate him for it, that he's speaking the truth. And that's important because you can be bombastic and loud and confident and say lies in front of people. And you might persuade some, you might be rhetorically gifted like the sophists, and yet you're not going to draw people in because of your gravitas. You might draw people in because you're manipulating them, but it's not going to be because you have gravitas, because you don't understand the truth. You're not treating something how it ought to be treated. But Christ, in his teaching, always does that. He treats things exactly as they ought to be treated because he made them, right? So that's one example of, you just called to mind with his teaching. The example that I was thinking about in preparation was Christ on the Sea of Galilee calming the storm. You have this vivid image. I say vivid image literally in some sense because you can look up paintings like the famous Rembrandt painting that was sadly stolen from a museum. We never found it. But it's Christ and the disciples on the Sea of Galilee in the midst of this storm. And again, as has been said by many a preacher, several of the disciples are fishermen. They're used to storms, right? This is not foreign to them. And they think we're about to die. So it's not like, okay, the wind is rocking us back and forth. That was a 3-foot wave. I'm kind of nervous. They're fearing for their lives, and some of them lived on the sea, right? That's what they did every day. So just a context there for how dramatic this scene is when it unfolds. And Jesus is sleeping on a cushion in the back of the boat.
It's really a funny image. You gotta love it.
They say, do you not care that we're perishing? And he stands up, he rebukes them for their lack of faith, right? He stands up and he rebukes the wind and the waves and immediately is calm, right? That's a kind of visceral image of a man with gravitas in the moment, right? When everyone about you is losing their heads. I mean, I say that, and even now I recognize I'm saying it that way because I'm almost quoting If by Rudyard Kipling on accident, right? But everybody about you is losing their heads and blaming it on you, right? Even as the disciples say, do you not care that we're perishing? But you keep your head, right? You keep your calm. You maintain control, at least of yourself and of those entrusted to you, if you can't control the situation, because we're going to be in situations like that where we can't rebuke the wind and the waves and make them stop. And they continue to rock and shake the boat, and we have to still make do, right? But he is just such a good example of gravitas in that story.
And there's so many other examples of gravitas in the life of Christ. Again, there's big dramatic ones, like that time when he knocks all the soldiers down in the garden, like, who are you seeking? Jesus of Nazareth, I am he, and they all fall over, right? Like, that's just wonderful. But his whole conduct in the Passion Week, his entering into the streets of Jerusalem on the donkey, his utter confidence in what he's set out to do, right? He sets his face towards Jerusalem, right? And he is going, he's unmoved by it, right? No one takes my life from me, but I lay it down. I am unmoved, but I will be moved for the sake of my people. He's in the garden and he's wrestling, but he ultimately submits his will to the Father. And then when the soldiers come and, you know, Peter hacks off the guy's ear, Jesus is just in utter command of the situation. And it's striking. His interview with Pilate, his authority, his composure. We often gloss over it and we picture him as sheep going to the slaughter is silent, right? Which is true, and that's a scriptural image as well. But we also, like, he was a man of authority who was in complete command. No one takes my life from me, but I lay it down, right? And that's wonderful.
Yeah, one picture that just came to mind thinking about, you know, Christ standing before Pilate, Christ in all of these situations coming into Jerusalem, like you said, has his face set towards Jerusalem, knowing his mission, knowing what he's going to do. That's so reminiscent to me of Aragorn in Lord of the Rings. Because throughout the book, Tolkien is trying to do this, right? He's doing it intentionally. He draws out so many times, even from the moment that they meet him in Bree, you know, when he draws out his sword and tells them who he is, and Frodo is taken aback because suddenly he seems taller and noble, and something comes over him that there's just this kingliness about Aragorn because he knows his mission to become king, to go and to save his people, that comes out again and again and again. And Tolkien does such a beautiful job of shining the spotlight on him in a metaphorical sense. Sometimes literally it's like a light descends upon him in the books, and suddenly he's not quite transfigured, but maybe transformed in a way so that the hobbits or the other men around him look at him and they kind of stand aghast for a moment, and then it passes because it's just a momentary glory before his embracing of the throne and inauguration. But yeah, I think he's such a good picture of gravitas. I mean, his words are full of wisdom. You know, he does at times make mistakes. He questions some of his decisions, but so often he's on the right path and he's not going to let people deter him from the right path, right? Eowyn pleading with him not to go through the paths of the dead because she doesn't want him to die. Or if he does die, she would rather him die in battle with Theoden and the Rohirrim. But he's not going to allow those pleas to do the wrong thing to sway him, even if it seems like from the outside that makes sense. Well, I know it's not the mission though. The mission is this, and I will set my mind on it and pursue it no matter what comes.
That's great. Yeah, that gravitas comes from knowing your mission. I think that's really good. Other examples that come into my mind, David, I think, is a wonderful example of gravitas. We often talk about David's mighty men, and I think that that's great. And you know, I named my son after one of David's mighty men, right? But we often forget that the actual description of the men they gather to him are like, they're a bunch of ruffians. Like, a lot of them are a bunch of scoundrels. And he somehow, at one point, right, when Ziklag is burned and all their wives and children are taken away, the men of his company, like his band, turn on him and want to stone him. So they're clearly a motley bunch, and yet he is able to keep them in his orbit, right? He clearly has kingship and command, right? And why? Because he knows his mission. Why? Because he knows he's Israel's king, and he's got to faithfully discharge his duties. But we even see it before, and I think this will get into something we'll talk about later. We see him growing in gravitas as time goes on. So his killing Goliath is just this moment of glorious command and authority, as he says, you know, who is this uncircumcised Philistine to defy the armies of the living God? I'll kill him. Right, I'm fixed on him. I'm going to take him. I'm confident of this, and it's compelling. And some of the guys hate it, right? But they let him do it, and sure enough, it works out. And even that was building off of something that came before. So talk to me about how gravitas is something that is built over time, something that is earned.
Well, I think it has to be earned. I mean, you could say, in one sense, I love coming back to David as an example. Actually, all of our examples so far are kings. Aragorn, Jesus, David, right? They're all kings, which is perfect because kings are great examples or test cases for gravitas. A king is owed reverence and respect by nature because of his position. The scriptures are clear here, right? We are to respect those who rule over us and even pray for them, pray for their good, right? Pray that they would be a blessing to the people, all of these things, including wicked rulers. We are to still revere and respect them insofar as we can, right? We don't respect or honor their wickedness, but their position. You could have a king and respect him and revere him, even if he doesn't have gravitas. And yet we all recognize that there's also this other category of king who you respect and revere, and you love to respect and revere. You're delighting in the fact that you respect him and revere him because he's worthy of it. And you don't only owe it to him, you do owe it to him, but you would give it even if you didn't owe it to him. You would give it to him even if he wasn't king, in other words. So I think that that kind of paradigm for us, there's a reason that we chose three kings to be our examples here. That kind of paradigm for us will help clarify what aspect of this is earned and what aspect of it isn't. Well, really, it's all earned in one sense. You're talking about who this man is and what he has become over time, like you said. And it has to be grown into. No three-year-old boy has gravitas, right? That's just not a category that three-year-olds operate in. They haven't lived enough. They don't have authority. They're not self-controlled. They're not dignified, right? They'll tear their diapers off and walk around naked in the middle of the restaurant, for crying out loud, right? There's no dignity there in that sense.
That does harm one's image. It's true. It does harm one's image.
Or at least it would, right? If you were an adult. I mean, with three-year-olds, people are usually like, wow, that's so cute. And not thinking about the fact that, well, it's cute to you, but I'm trying to like help control my son's thoughts and actions here. And man, it's been a day. So it has to be earned in that sense. I mean, you can look at the Proverbs and think about Solomon writing to his son to become king and teaching him wisdom, right? Teaching him how to grow into becoming a good king. And there's a kind of corollary there with gravitas. It has to be built up over time. So as you have responsibility, as you have leadership capacity or roles kind of thrust upon you or that you seek out for yourself, you build up gravitas over time, much like you build up muscle by working out or by working outside and doing manual labor. You build up skill in a sport by practicing. Gravitas is similar, that is built over time. It can't just come in a moment.
Unlike authority and respect, which actually can, you could imagine a three-year-old king, right? And he's totally the king, and he's pulling his diaper off on the throne, but you know what? That's a little embarrassing, but that doesn't change the fact that he's king and that you owe him your fealty, right? But though you owe him respect and fealty, he does not compel you.
And in that sense, not based on his position, but based on his character and maturity, he doesn't deserve it yet. You're giving it to him at that moment purely because of his position, whereas you hope one day that he becomes a great and noble king that you can give it to gladly and that you're proud of.
Such that if he were then dethroned and you no longer owed him fealty based upon position, you would say, I'm sticking with that guy, actually. Like, I'm riding off into exile with you because you compel me.
Right. Yeah. Well, here's another couple of questions here, and then we can maybe get into how can we build up gravitas, because we're touching on that now. I mentioned the metaphor of working out, right, building strength over time, and there's some compelling correlation there between physicality, the physicality of a man and his gravitas. You can think about the 6'5" man who has hands the size of your face and shakes your hand as a young boy, and you just are in awe of his presence, and he draws you in that way, right? How much of gravitas is physical? Is it a physical thing? Do those things mirror each other? Do they complement one another? What do you think?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question to think about, because I don't think you can say that it has no bearing on the physical realm, right? That if there is, you know, a man who is larger, a man who has a deeper voice, a man who is physically stronger in the physical realm, right, is going to compel you to some degree. You're going to listen when he talks, right? And I think that that's an important point to not get past. We're incarnate creatures, right? The physical is not bad. We're not just souls, right? That actually how we interact with the world of matter matters. And so when God makes a man very big, he didn't earn it. He's just naturally very large. That's God. God did that, and God did that in some ways to give you a picture of gravitas, right? That man is hard to move, literally. Like, if he were to keel over, you would have a hard time getting him out of the restaurant, right? right? He is hard to move. So I don't think we should brush past that and say, doesn't matter. Now, then there's also this aspect of it. If I encounter a man who's very strong, my inclination is to think that man does hard things. That man goes and he picks up heavy things and puts them down. Or that man works as a lumberjack. He is accustomed to buffeting his body and making it his slave for whatever reason, right? And there can be good reasons and bad reasons. But when I see a man's physical strength, I am also acknowledging something about his character. It's not necessary. He could just have been given really big muscles by God. But probably, I am actually admiring something about his character. And then similarly, I think that it's silly to say that a man's physical body doesn't matter for this, right? Some have been given a head start, but you can squander a head start. And that's all the more embarrassing. You can be very big and strong and flippant and wishy-washy and undependable. That's all the more tragic. So if you're sitting there and you're thinking, I'm I'm a buck 40, right? And sopping wet. And I've got nothing about me that physically compels. I think we can take comfort in the fact that the same was said of Christ, right? Not the buck 40 part. But like we're told, he had no natural majesty. He had no natural beauty or glory. There's nothing that made you, as far as we understand from Isaiah, if you saw Jesus in a crowd just walking along, you wouldn't be like, oh man, that guy is the Son of God, right? And yet, he's the pinnacle of gravitas. Like he is the ultimate example, not just like categorically, but also practically. Like we see it in the scriptures. So this, I think, is comfort to us that while the physical is not irrelevant, it is more fundamentally about your soul. It is more fundamentally about who you are, your proven character.
Absolutely. I think this is the perfect point in the conversation for a good sports analogy. So when you think about the NFL and who on a football team has gravitas, what positions naturally lend themselves towards that? Well, obviously the quarterback is one that you would hope has gravitas to lead the team, to compel action on the part of other players and to hold them accountable, to be the person who brings everyone together. You talked about squandering the physical gift and, okay, I'm going to use two Hall of Fame quarterbacks here. So you could say how much of this is squandered because they're going to be Hall of Fame quarterbacks, right? But if you look at Aaron Rodgers and Tom Brady, they are so different in so many ways. And it pains me to use this analogy because I'm going to hold Tom Brady up over Aaron Rodgers in some ways. And I'm a Packers fan.
I'm sorry for what this does to you.
Yeah. So you have in Aaron Rodgers, somebody who comes into the league and he's projected as the top pick, maybe number two, maybe number three. He slides down into the 20s and took that as a slight for like all of his career and held it against people. But that's still first round. Okay. You're a first round quarterback. Everybody recognizes you have the tools, you have the physical talent and the gifts, you have the mind of a quarterback, and you can do this at the next level. We're taking you in the first round. And they, you know, they put him behind Brett Favre for a few years, and then he goes and wins a Super Bowl and four MVPs and is clearly one of the most talented quarterbacks, maybe the most talented to ever play the sport. Okay. So he's got all the physical gifts. And yet, what do people say about him now who have played with him? Well, he's got people who are close to him still, but so many people, I mean, it just, at first, I as a Packers fan would defend him and say, okay, how much of the story are we getting? We haven't heard from Aaron yet, whatever, but so many people over so many years have just talked about his lack of leadership. And I don't want to cast too many aspersions on him without being there, but if so many people say it over so much time, there's got to be something there that's missing, right? Whereas you look at Tom Brady and it's the opposite story. Physically, he looked like a bum. He was taking the, fifth or sixth round, something. He ran like the slowest 40 time in the history of sports, maybe. Not literally, but it seemed
really?
Like that when you watch
him.
Yeah, I mean, he takes off his shirt at the combine. He's just kind of this like thin but a little flabby guy who's, you know, everybody thinks like he can be a backup for a couple of years and then he'll be out of the league. Then he has the confidence to go up to Robert Kraft after the Patriots draft him, the owner of the team, and say, you know, something like, you just made the best decision in your franchise's history, right? And then he goes on to have a Hall of Fame career, and then people start to wonder, is he about to retire? You know, 35, 36, 37, is he done? He got hurt, and he's out of it. And then has another career worthy of the Hall of Fame after that point, right? And it's just crazy to think about how much he did. But it's not just the winning. It's what do players say about Tom Brady who played with him? I don't know that I've ever heard anybody say anything negative about him. They say he was there first. He did the work. He was an example to us. He called us out if we did the smallest thing wrong, but he held himself to the same standard and he drew the best out of us at all times. And the other Hall of Fame players who played with him say that about him. Like he was the example for them and he drew out their talent and their ability, right? So he's the underdog in the story and yet he has the mindset, he has the vision of his mission, like we said at the beginning, that just totally has a kind of stranglehold on everything that he does. He's driven by this mission to be the greatest and look at what he achieves. And, yep. And so it's just a perfect kind of example of not being set up for success in the eyes of everybody, right? The NFL scouts, the GMs who are passing on him multiple. I mean, imagine telling somebody if you were the GM for a football team, I passed on Tom Brady 6 times. I didn't take him 6 times and took all of these other players. You just ruined your franchise, right? And yet,
I didn't think I was doing it at the time.
That's right. That touches on one last question here, and then we can kind of move on, which is, we've talked about Kings. Now we've talked about the quarterbacks here a little bit. This is maybe more natural to think about with Kings, but is gravitas something that is distant? Does gravitas mandate that we hold people at a distance? If so, how? If not, how much of that is needed? What do you think?
Yeah, this is a really tough one for me personally, because I wrestle with this in as I'm a teacher, as I'm a pastor, as I'm, even as a father. You know, to what extent is it right and fitting for me to have a warm and friendly relationship with my students, with my children? Right. Obviously, you want that to some extent, but I've wrestled with that in the past. Am I actually hindering them by being less authoritarian than I ought to be? Right. You know, sometimes they give them what's the adage that you give new teachers? Don't smile till Christmas. Right. The idea is that you should be removed. You're not here to be their friend. They should be largely afraid of you for the majority of, certainly for this early portion. And then, you know, in the spring semester, you can lighten up. And once you've established that respect.
And then you have them over to your house and you eat dinner with them, right?
No smiling.
No smiling at dinner. Yeah. It builds over time. Like that's so important. Not being, when you tell teachers, hey, you're not the friend of the student, that doesn't mean you're not friendly. That doesn't mean you're not polite. That doesn't mean you don't tell jokes. But there's a certain kind of relationship that you're trying to cultivate, and it's one of authority.
Yes. So in answer to the question, I don't think it has to be distant. If by distant we mean cold, aloof, not having full-on contact. And yet, there has to be authority. And so there is this fundamental difference betwixt yous and me's, right? Because I'm the one telling you what to do. I'm the one calling the shots. I have this authority that you don't have, even if it's an authority that I've assumed, even if it's not a position that I have, but it's an authority that I've assumed. And so there is this difference betwixt us. And so, I have to say yes to both in some respects. It's a tough one. This is one that I'm like actively working through at the moment.
Yeah, here are my thoughts on it. I kind of think about it this way. Your gravitas kind of harmonizes with the position that you hold, and that determines how distant or how near you are. Again, not in the sense that you're cold, but the example I would give is me moving from being a full-time teacher at Augustine to the dean of the upper school. I noticed pretty early on, my relationship looks different with these students, and it needs to look different, because when I was a teacher, we were all under the same authority. The students are under my authority, but we're all answering to the dean, right? So when we have some event or something changes unexpectedly or something, you know, happens and this is the school's policy or response to it and the students are bummed about it or, you know, whatever fun event gets canceled, then I as a teacher didn't make that decision. And so I might not grovel in it with them. I might tell them to stop complaining, but I also don't have to bear the weight of them looking at me thinking you canceled our fun thing or you made this decision we don't like. That responsibility wasn't mine as a teacher. When I became dean, it was my responsibility. It is, right? And so my relationship with students is different because they will look to me and ask those questions that they won't ask of their teachers because they know their teachers didn't have anything to do with it, at least not directly, right? They might have given counsel or whatever behind the scenes, but the students don't see that. They don't know who said what, who was in favor, who was against. We just kind of present the united front, but they know to go to me and say, hey, why are we doing it this way? Or why this change? Or, you know, it could be positive things too. Like, I'm so thankful that we did this as a school, you know, that we made this change, whatever it is. But I realized that the greater responsibility meant there's going to be more scrutiny from my people, these students who I love. And so there needs to be some amount of distance, again, not in a cold way, but just that we are not, I guess we're one step further removed from each other, right? When I was a teacher, I was there in the classroom with the students every day. But now it's like the students often are relating to me. They're hearing about decisions or things like that through their teachers. So it's mediated. So there's more kind of natural distance that way. I mean, and maybe in some sense you could compare that to being a grandfather. I don't know. I'm not a grandfather, but I imagine it's kind of similar, right? You know, you relate to your grandkids in one sense, like you just love them and pick them up and read to them and take them fishing or whatever. And you don't have to deal with as much of the discipline and stuff. But in another sense, if you're thinking about the seriousness, the graveness, there is more natural distance because you're not living with them every day, probably. And so you kind of approach your grandfather wondering, who is he? What's his story? I'm not so familiar with him. I'm not going to speak to him like I speak to my father. Even if I speak to my father in a respectful way, right? I'm much more familiar with him. I'm much more comfortable with him. But who is this man who has this iron handshake and I know fought in wars and all of these? Like, right? You just have a kind of mysteriousness and inquisitiveness as a child about your grandfather oftentimes. I don't know. Those are two examples of how I think your position kind of affects that and what gravitas demands.
It seems like in some ways the one with gravitas is in control of the distance. So the one with gravitas can go grab the little daughter and snuggle and read the book and be as close as he wants to be. And then the one with gravitas is also able to take a step removed.
That's right.
And that the one with gravitas is in control of that. So when he wants to present himself to his people, whether they be students or children or subjects or whatever, he can do that. But they can't necessarily come to him. He can choose to come to them, but they can't necessarily just approach him. That gets a little tricky with children. Like, shouldn't children be able to come up to their dad? But in some respects, like, yeah, they should. But also...
Yeah, and not at any time and in any way. Like, there are times where it wouldn't be appropriate for you to run up to your dad as a little kid and jump in his lap and snuggle him or whatever. He might be in the midst of something. For instance, you're sitting down with your family and you realize we need to make some changes around something where a TV or homework time or sports or whatever, right? Or we need to be outside more. And you're sitting down, you want to talk to your kids about it and have a serious conversation about, like, hey, let me cast a vision for you and talk about what we're doing. And then your 4-year-old says, hey, can you read this book? Like, no, not right now. After this, yes, absolutely. And I'll read it to you 5 times in a row. But this is not the time. I like that kind of statement. It's kind of in their control, the person with gravitas, because I think about my relationship with students and wanting to be very careful, like you said, about not pulling back too far. And so I still go out with kids at lunch and throw the baseball. And, you know, we sit around the fire and talk. And yet they don't just walk into my office and throw a baseball at me, right? They recognize that there are times and ways that we interact in a more relaxed way, in a much more familiar way. And I love that. I've gone on camping trips with students and all of these things. And yet there are times that I have to deliver news or a decision or something that I know the students aren't going to like. And that's, I don't come with a baseball glove, you know, being flippant and saying, hey, after this, we're going to go play catch. Like, no, I know that I'm telling you something that's going to be upsetting and I'll give you some time to reckon with that. And then sure, you know, later at lunch, maybe we'll throw the baseball or something. So I do want to get to this idea of growing in gravitas and kind of make this more practical. What are some ways that you can think of to grow in gravitas? And then maybe at the same time, we can talk about how does that affect your children, right? Why is it important for them to see you growing in gravitas in these ways? What does it do to a child to see his or her father growing in gravitas over time? So how do we get it and how does it affect our kids? Any initial thoughts?
one of the most comforting words that I ever heard on this subject. Well, I should say, when this vision was first kind of cast for me, for like, what is gravitas? I think the line was, this, you give an example, it's like, this is gravitas and you want it. And I was like, yep, I do. That's it. And I want it. And then, but then this question is like, okay, cool. Now, how do you get it? All right. And it's easy to think like, no, it's something you're born with, or it's something that you have to obtain through arcane rituals or whatever. But he said, this particular author said, no, you get gravitas by doing your daily duty. That's it. Period. End of story. Like, there's only one path. That's the bad news. The good news is that it's just whatever is set in front of you, you do it as faithfully as you can. And you trust God. And he's perfectly capable of bringing you big, scary things, right? So this is, I think, why the example of David is just wonderful. Where is he? He's out with the sheep. His brothers say, why did you leave those few sheep, right? So it's probably not even that many sheep. He's like doing this really menial task and that takes very little effort. And yet God brings him a bear. And then he's like, well, that's what's in front of me, so I should do it, right? And he kills the bear. And then God brings him a lion. And he's like, all right. Or maybe the lion was first. I don't know. And then he's like, all right, well, I guess I'm going to kill the lion now. Right? And then God brought him a giant. He's like, well, guess I got to kill the giant. So the daily performance of duty, the fear God, keep his commandments over the long haul. And there's no shortcut to gravitas. And that's a discouraging word in some ways, but it's also really comforting. Like, there's no way to get it other than just doing your daily duty. That's the way to do it. And I think that's wonderful for dads to hear, because a lot of our work feels really small and it feels really trivial. And yet, if I believe that doing that daily work is what's going to ultimately make me unmovable, that's comforting.
The idea that we can't go from 0 to 100 overnight should be an encouragement, like you said, because you look at a man who just exudes gravitas. I mean, you think about some of the men that you respect most in your life, and that's one of the reasons, no doubt, that you respect them is because they have some measure of gravitas. And you think to yourself, how could I ever be like him? Right? I can't get there, because you see how far away you are. But that's like saying to the horizon, I could never reach that horizon. Right, I could never get to that island that I can see because it's so far away. Well, no, you can't, if by that you mean you can't just appear there immediately, but you can sail there, right? You can get the sails in line and take a certain tack, and then you just sail there little by little, right? And okay, maybe you've got a really small sail and it's got some tatters in it. Well, maybe you climb up and sew the holes in the sail and so that it catches wind a little more fully. You make some of those adjustments, and now you're well on your way. I think tying it to duty is so essential, that you just do your duty. You fulfill the duty and the task that God has put in front of you that day. And if we can just, I think as Christians in general, in so many ways, so many aspects of the Christian life comes down to, am I going to be faithful today with what the Lord puts in front of me? And if we could think that way more, we would grow in holiness and a love for God and a love for the church, and all of these things would bring blessing and fruit in our lives. But specifically to gravitas, think about, what has God given you to do at work, right? What has he given you to do as a father? What has he given you to do as a husband? Do those things well today. Recognize that when you do them, you're doing them first and foremost for his sake and for his glory. And then second, that he's preparing you, like you used the example with David, the lion and the bear, and then Goliath, a giant who can fight back and can reason and has these weapons, right? Far more fearsome than this mere beast. And yet David had been prepared. The Lord set these things up for him so that he could walk in them successfully, which is just an encouraging thing, that he walks with us day by day, and that if we catch the vision and run after it, he will make the steps clear. We will be able to see clearly what it is that he's asking us to do. So I would just say, like, find a mission and stick to it and take the next step each day, and recognize that there are different aspects to that, right? Like I mentioned, with work, with family, at church, there are different avenues that you're going to be walking in. Kind of try to get specific on those and treat them seriously. Avoid being flippant about those things. On the other hand, you mentioned Aristotle earlier. So one side of the the golden mean when you get into vice would be flippancy, not taking serious things seriously. I think the other side is probably something like, I don't have a word for this, but taking yourself too seriously or taking something else too seriously. Christian, I remember one day freshman year said to us, maybe it was from a sermon or something, I can't remember, but he said, "You're not a big deal. Don't take yourself too seriously. God is a big deal. Take him seriously." And that fundamentally kind of transformed my view of myself. And it just gave me a helpful paradigm to think about day-to-day life. Is this a big deal? Well, it's not God, so it's less important than that, at least. Okay, I don't have to make this the most serious thing in my life right now. How do I honor that God then in whatever's in front of me, right? I'm just going to walk in that.
That's right. And to be able to do the duty set in front of you requires humility, right? It requires patience. It requires self-control. All of these things are things that translate directly to the building of gravitas. But humility and contentment is not the same thing as sloth, right? And it's not like you lack ambition or you lack drive. No, do all you can with what you got, right? But assume that what you've been given is plenty, right? Assume that you've been given, that whatever is right in front of you is fertile ground. Or assume that you've got building materials here for a whole city. Or that these woods that you've been told to guard contain bears. And God is perfectly capable of bringing you plenty of adventure. So contentment, humility, know your place, but recognize that your place contains plenty enough for you.
I think on that note, that's what your kids will see, right? They will recognize when you're doing that and when you're walking well and like dad's got this vision and he's so full of energy and drive for the task in front of him. And I want to imitate that. And I want to get into that with him and buy into the vision. And if we ever find ourselves not in that state, if we find ourselves thinking, man, I kind of wish God would give me more already so that I could, you know, do more and use my gifts to the fullness of their capacity and all of these things, it's probably because we're not being faithful with what he's put in front of us, right? If we're not...
Almost certainly.
Yeah, if we're not feeling like, man, my hands are full, I'm carrying this massive box and it's actually got three boxes stacked on top, it's a sign that we're not using our gifts the way we should be, because he's going to add something to our pile, right? To our responsibilities, and add the strength to do that and the capacity to do that kind of at the same time, right? It's not like you work yourself into this position where you could be maxing 200, but you're stuck at 100 because God won't give you any more weights, right? That's just not how he works. And
no,
yeah. And so just pray for that, right? Pray for those, you know, eyes to see that, eyes to see the fullness of the task that he set in front of you, and then fulfill it with all your might, right? Work with all your might. And your kids will see that. They'll love that. And they will, I've found, you know, I still have very young kids, but I've found this to be true, that our boys seem so secure when I have, and I try to just make this the front that I give them, even when I'm kind of uncertain behind the scenes, right? I try not to project that to them, but they seem so kind of confident and comfortable with the fact that they know where I work, they know where we go to church, and that's what dad does, and that's who he is, and he's responsible for, you know, part of what goes on at this school, and this is our church that we're a part of, and, you know, we're always going to be there, and if we're in another town going to another church, we're like, when are we going to go back to our church, or what are they preaching about at our church, or whatever, you know, all of these things, because they recognize this is our place. This is the work that we have to do. And you give them, in some sense, a home, right? A sense of belonging here, because you're on mission in this place. And so there's a safety and security and a trust that comes from that.
And that's what you want them to grow up to do. You want them to grow up and do the duty that's set in front of them. And you want them to be doing their duties now, right? And so when you model it for them, when you model for your sons doing things that are hard, you model for your sons doing the thing that's set in front of you, even when it is unglamorous. Like, those are going to be things that muscles that they will need as they fulfill their own various callings.
Yeah, I mean, you give in a, you know, a corollary way to our wives, right? We give our boys a model to imitate, and we give our daughters something to desire. And the same is true of our wives, right? Our wives model something for our daughters. And they give our sons something to desire, something to look for in a wife, right? I mean, there's the old adage, right? You marry your mother, right? You always find someone who so much resembles your mother, at least hopefully in good ways, right? Because she trains you what to look for. And so we train our boys how to act, and our daughters, you know, what is it that makes a good man? What is it that you ought to desire in a husband? And so when they see you living out gravitas, they're going to have an example, kind of a blueprint for what they're looking forward to.
I hadn't thought about that before, that by modeling gravitas, by modeling virtue generally, you're not only shaping your sons, but you're shaping your future sons-in-law. I never thought about that before. Like, oh, yeah, by providing a standard for my daughters about what is a good man, I am in some sense showing them what they should look for in a godly husband.
Yeah. That's the hope, right? That's our desire. So, you know, as dads, when we're around our girls, we don't get to slack off because we're not training them to be men. And our wives don't get to slack off because they're not training our boys to be women, right? You're just training them in different ways with different things. I think that's all the time we have for today. So let's get to book recommendations. Josh, what book do you have to recommend to our listeners this week?
Yeah, the one that I have today is actually, I referenced it earlier, I just didn't reference it by name. So this is the book that first put me onto the topic of gravitas. This is Man of the House by C.R. Wiley. All of Wiley's books are great. His books are nice and short and punchy, and they're all about what it means to be a good and godly man. What I like about Man of the House is that it's extremely practical. And he's thinking he does not attack things from the big philosophical, theological perspective as much. He's more like, all right, you know, how do you provide for your family? How do you build a legacy? And so that was where I first encountered the topic of gravitas, and it was extremely compelling and still is. So A Man of the House by C.R. Wiley.
Oh, great. And my book this week is The Tech Exit by Claire Morrell. I heard her recently at the ACCS conference. She had a kind of breakout session called The Tech Exit. And she was helping us think through as schools what our role is and coming along parents and thinking through what access we give our children to technology and really what access we don't give them, more importantly. She talks a lot in the book about you know the negative side effects that are incredibly far-reaching of social media and smartphone usage and video games for children. And the lie of moderation and the lie of parental controls, I would just really encourage any parent who's thinking through these things, even if you think, well, my children are already teenagers or whatever, and we've already lost this battle and I wish that I could go back, but I can't. And so to change it, you know, it would be self-defeating. That's just not true. She gives a good kind of roadmap for how you can kind of test these things and how you talk to your kids about them if they're older, about the reasoning for making some of these changes and getting them off of social media, getting them away from smartphones and games and things like this, and how much joy it leads to. Because it's not, she talks to a bunch of families and it's not just about the rules that these families kind of put in place. It's far more about the life that they wanted to cultivate for their children. And so that's what their families focus on. That's what she focuses on in the book is what do we want for our kids? We want them to have the childhood that we had, which is growing up outside, playing with friends, kids from the neighborhood come around and play baseball outside. You're not worried about what so-and-so in California thinks because you don't know them and haven't ever heard what they said, right? You're not on Facebook. You're not on Twitter or Instagram or whatever. You're not comparing yourself in these ways. I just thought it was so helpful and so insightful. So I wholeheartedly commend that book for anybody who still has kids in the house, no matter what stage you're in and no matter kind of what your thoughts are so far on technology, because I think you'll probably learn something and be encouraged in some good ways to make positive improvements.
Nice. Sounds great.
Well, that's all we have for today. So thank you for joining us. We hope that you've been edified and blessed by this episode. If you have any questions for us, feel free to reach out at pintswithtreebeard@gmail.com and let us know what you thought about the episode. If there are things that you'd like us to talk about in the future, if you have any questions for the show, you can reach us there. And until next time, we'll see you later.
Cheerio.
Welcome to Pints with Treebeard. I'm Jameson Winter. I'm a... Okay, so now here's the thing that I was about to do. I was about to say, I'm a pastor and theological educator in Jackson, Tennessee, because that's what Aaron says for his Old Roads podcast. Okay.